Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined on the line by actually three additional hosts, because we're going to have a bit of a two-on-two grudge match in the ring this week, starting with you, Matt. How are you, Matt?
I'm great. Glad to be here. I just started back at school, teaching back at VCU, School of the Arts in Richmond, Virginia.
So, Matt, you're on my team. That would be team what, the WTF team. And on the opposing team is, I believe, Jason Diamond.
Howdy, sirs.
How are you? I guess cheerleader for the other team is Kanan Flowers. How are you, Kanan?
I'm good.
So,
I like being called the cheerleader.
You begged to be on this for reasons of, I think, partly enthusiasm for the film, partly guilt after making me see the film in the first place. The film in question is Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Our issue is twofold. We're going to discuss, obviously, the VFX, as we always do. And, of course, it's a VFX show. What do you expect us to do? The reason this became controversial is that a couple of us just expressed strong opinions on this offline, dear listeners, and it wasn't really that we had a major problem with the visual effects, though I certainly think the visual effects were part of the problem in my world, but definitely we had some issues with the film. And I'm going to go further and say that our actual kind of, because we like to have two topics. We talk about the film's visual effects, and we normally come to some aspect of that, which is normally, you know, technologically related. This week, I would like to suggest that Comic-Con sucks would be a good parallel topic, and I will explain why when we get into it. But let's start with our roundup on the film. And I'm going to start with people that actually saw the whole film without walking out. I'm going to start with you, Kanan.
So the question is, do I like the film? The answer is yes. If the question is, why do I like the film, that's a really long discussion, and I think we'll definitely get into that. Some of it has to do with the visual effects, some of it has to do with the style, and some of it has to do with the choices that the filmmakers made. I am going to be even further controversial on this topic and say that this film, I believe, is going to have the same kind of impact in the world of cinema that Fight Club had on cinema.
Oh, God. Please, just this is such an outrageous claim as to be positively provocative. Jason Diamond, what did you think?
I actually did enjoy the film very much myself as well, if I could string all those weird words together. And again, for the same reasons. I think the visual effects, the style, and I'm a huge Edgar Wright fan all the way back from Spaced on BBC through now, and I don't think the story itself was a little below my age group to age in myself in the crowd here, but overall, I think I really enjoyed it, had a lot of fun.
Now, Matt, what did you think of this slacker daydream film about a kid who's a star in his own film in his own head, yet alone wasting our time in cinemas?
Well, you know, I went to this movie with my wife, and we had she really wanted to see it after seeing the previews and stuff, and I was excited to go see it just because I knew it had some interesting visual effects in it and thought it would be fun to just check out and see what they did. And we sat down, and the movie started, and I really gave it the best shot I could give it, and about an hour and maybe 10 minutes into the movie, my wife and I looked over at each other, and we both were like, do you want to get out of here? And we both decided to leave, and we got up and walked out and went and got dinner instead. And we both kind of were talking about it afterwards, and we both kind of had the same reaction, which was almost like a kind of anxiety attack of onslaught of what I thought were some really interesting transitions, but horrible editing and pacing. It reminded me a lot of what I think is one of the worst edited movies of the modern age, which is Sylvester Stallone in the movie Cobra. As well as one of my favorite fight scenes of all time in They Live, John Carpenter's They Live with Rowdy Roddy Piper and what's his nuts fighting
Keith
for
David.
Yeah, for what seems like, I believe, 45 minutes. It was a movie that I felt like had you know, some interesting things going for it going into the theater, and enough to make me want to come go and see it. But it just didn't deliver. And I went through some of the materials that Todd and Matt put together in the dossier, and reading some of the reviews, I thought, you know, David Edelstein in New York Magazine, as well as the whoever wrote the review in the New York Post and the Variety review, I mean, they all just nailed it, like, in terms of what I saw. Now, I kind of feel a little bit like kind of a douchey bastard by sort of slagging on the film when I actually didn't see the whole thing. So, you know, there is that caveat that...
Dude, it didn't change between the bit you saw and the end. If anything, it went downhill. But Cohen, continue.
I guess I just sort of felt like, you know, I'm a fan of movies about young people. You know, I think probably one of the best, I mean, some of the best ones are sort of mimics of one. Well, one of them is a mimic of the other. But, you know, films like American Graffiti, a classic sort of coming of age teenage film, and then Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, which I think is, you know, a brilliant film that has some, you know, teenage angst and some fighting.
By the way, both movies pre-video games.
Well, really pre, well, not pre, American Graffiti, but not Dazed and Confused. I mean, they were console games. I mean, they were probably pretty shitty games, but they did exist, didn't they? I mean,
yeah, but it wasn't, anyway,
it wasn't the video game world. Yeah.
I guess like the thing that I walked out of the film feeling was that, you know, it was the first time I ever felt like I was too old for a movie. Now, I don't think of myself as being that old. I'm 40 years old, but I walked out of that movie and I thought, God, you know, it's the first time I ever really felt like I was too old for a film. Like, it didn't, and I said, you know, to my wife, I said, I think the only way that I could have actually watched that movie and enjoyed it without feeling like I was about to go into a massive panic attack might have been if I had, you know, a serious case of ADD.
Okay, so let me give my take on it, and then we'll swing back to Jason and Cannon. And here's my thing. I think that if you were to listen, and I swear to God, I've done a lot of research on this film. It's not like I'm dismissing it out of hand. I've listened to several in-depth interviews with the director and the writer team from a scripting level. And I've got to tell you, if you would have not seen the film and listened to those, the level of intellectualization of the process, the cultural references, the film references, the level of respect to the material, like, there's just every tick box you could possibly go through, how they reference, you know, Drowning by Numbers through to the films that you mentioned. In fact, they actually explicitly mentioned some of those films and watched all of those teen angst films, the coming of age films, and tried to cross them with the kung fu films. They watched a ton of stuff. They even went through and wrote down from IMDb all the great quotes that would be possibly interpreted at two levels, like, she's out of your, you know, she's at the next level, she's out of your league kind of thing, to try and see if they could find this really interesting zeitgeist cultural shift between the video gamer and the romantics, and where they could underpin that and link it through. And they shot this for 5.5 months. This was not a film that was rushed. So if you were to analyze, without seeing the film, all this stuff, you would be, man, this is the film to go to. Then you'd look up what the director had done before. So, wow, this director's done comedy before. It's a great, you know, and I'm sure some of you will point out that the director has done incredibly good things before. Though I would point out, you get no points with me for the film that I didn't see. You only want to talk about the film I am seeing or did see. And I'm sorry, but the film I saw, that just did not deliver on the complexity that went into it. And I think there's two reasons for it. One is that it was heavily stylized over content. Like, there is some really good stuff in there that works in the trailer that could clearly make you want to see the film. My daughters wanted to see it. I thought the trailer looked funny. I think that's part of it. Like, I think it really works well in short form. In long form, it just tired tremendously. And the second thing that I think I'll say is that it's the Comic-Con effect. It's this idea that we have so elevated comic books to a place way beyond what they deserve, that we're treating them like literature of Shakespeare or fine writing at a level that requires such a an honest treatment and respect to the literature. And I just don't think it warrants it. You know, the guy put out 6 comic books about 7 boyfriends getting beaten, though I know they weren't all boys. And you know what? The film just became, oh, please, do I have to sit through another one of these before I get to the end? And then even the ending, where we discover that the narrator is an unreliable narrator in the first place. So this is really just like cheating me at so many levels. I just felt the film didn't deliver. So my problem is not that I don't get what it was trying to do. I think my problem is I just didn't like what it was doing. But please, the red team in the other corner, tell me I'm wrong.
But wait, Mike, you're the one who said that The Dark Knight was the godfather of
our
this generation.
Yep.
And that comes directly from...
No, it doesn't. No, no, I'm calling you on that right away out of the gate.
Wait,
that is
not,
absolutely not a frame-for-frame cartoon representation.
I didn't say frame-for-frame. I just said it spanned the... history with some creative interpretation of
it's a film Batman. First and it references a mythology from a comic book second. This darn thing tries to recreate frames and it's trying to do a comic book video game as a film. I'm sorry, I'll play my video games, I'll read the comic book, or I'll see a film. I don't want all three in one experience. I'm sorry, Jason, I totally disrespect you permanently now for bringing that up. For daring to grace this podcast with Dark Knight references. How dare you? I'm sorry. Kanan, you can talk. Jason, you're in the sin bin.
I get it now.
Kanan?
You know, Mike, I just want to say you're the one who brought up The Dark Knight being the godfather. No, I'm just kidding. I think that it goes back a little bit to something that you know, when we talk about Dazed and Confused and we talk about these other films, you know, we hear phrases like, you know, if it's too loud, you're too old. Well, I would say in the case of this film, you know, I think there might be a kind of intellectualization that's going on where people have a certain expectation that's very lofty, this kind of New York cocktail party expectation. And they're not looking at the reality of a fusion of different mediums that seems to be happening in our culture. You know, this idea of all these things are social networking and comic books and all of this. You know, we can slam on comic books as not being literature, but I will be the first to point out that I think that is completely untrue and can give you many, many examples of comic books that are far superior to their, quote, literary counterparts.
And I'm so just angry at how much comic books are ruining the film industry. Like Comic-Con, that comic trade show is become... Because this film played really well at Comic-Con. They made this film for the audience that applauded at that trade show. I'm sorry, but that is
okay,
not
wait.
An audience that is...
And I agree with you on that level, but what I don't think we should do is blame comic books in general. In a way, what we should be blaming is lazy directors who look at a comic book and go, you know, holy shit, I have a pre-built storyboard for my film.
Okay,
let
now,
me just shoot
but he
that.
Wasn't lazy. See, this is my point, though. This is
no,
a guy
this,
who
this
wasn't lazy.
This filmmaker was not lazy.
He right. just respected the material in a way that translated to a film that, in my opinion, doesn't work. Anyway, keep going. Fair enough. Go on.
We have this – the reason I think that I'm giving it a comparison to Fight Club is actually ironically, and you've sort of proven my point for me, for exactly the same reasons that people hated Fight Club when it came out. When Fight Club came out, it did horribly badly in the box office, and I remember all of these reviews saying Fight Club sucks because this book written by Chuck Palahniuk is nothing more than a screenplay wrapped inside of the pretense of being a novel. And all this guy did was take that and turn it into a, you know, it was meant to be a screenplay, it was meant to be a movie, and this guy just shot it, and so, you know, he sucks and doesn't know what he's doing. And I think I'm hearing a lot of that same thing echoed in Scott Pilgrim, and I think it's going to set a pace for how films are done in the future in the same way Fight Club did. You know, we can't arbitrarily look at a comic book medium and say, oh, it sucks and we should stop making comic book movies. But we can look at how people are taking comic books and turning them into movies.
Okay, so I am leading the backlash that is over criticizing comic books because we so resent what they've done to the film industry that we have no one else to hate. I fully represent somebody that's overreacting, but someone's got to, because it's got out of control.
But listen, it's the same thing as saying like, oh, I hate this band for making really shitty music, but it's not the band's fault. It's the public's fault for allowing them to consume it to a point where it allows them to be popular.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jason. Did we think that the public consumed this film?
Well, not yet, but they're consuming comic book culture in general, which is what you're talking about.
Okay, you're talking about okay. The comic fair enough.
So if someone says, "Oh, Dark Knight, this is going to be huge," and it's huge. So someone says, "Okay, well, we're not going to make a gothic, you know, masterpiece like Dark Knight, but hey, here's this cool little like tween angst, you know, story about a kid in a band who is obsessed with video games and this girl. That could be a fun thing." And oh, guess what?
Okay. It's got a good hands following. Hands up, and we're gonna who follow. Owns a copy of any one of these six books or had read,
but
properly
read? We are
read.
Not the audience. We are not the target audience. The only reason we are interested
even
is
I have a copy of a Dark Knight comic back from the 80s, right?
Right, but that was written in the 80s when you were younger.
My point was, though, that that Batman is an incredibly well-known franchise, extraordinarily well-known, and entrenched in popular culture, and is just nowhere in the same zone as the school of people that would have say, oh, Scott Pilgrim, I really loved it in what they did in book five. I mean, it's just like, just because it's a graphic novel doesn't give it the weight of something as influential as a Batman.
I wasn't comparing them in terms of literary or influential weight. I was just saying that it falls under in the sort of basically bullshit Hollywood system where they say, oh, what's doing well? That. Okay, let's look at the food pyramid underneath and with, let's say, Dark Knight at the top and Iron Man, and then you have, you know, one or two sitting at the top, and you have 100 sort of average shitty books at the bottom, but you could make decent movies out of them that'll do well at the box office and in global sales. We'll make those too. It's not that I'm not blaming filmmaking or I'm just saying it's a larger economic issue than just, oh, who bought the Scott Pilgrim book?
If I might, I guess I would just say on some level that, you know, I don't know. When I think about just this film in particular, I think it would be difficult for me to speak, you know, directly to the larger issues of Comic-Con's influence on, you know, Hollywood filmmaking. I mean, I think it's sort of unfortunate. I don't know if it's Comic-Con's responsibility or if Comic-Con is sort of the culpable or responsible party in some of the demise of, although I don't even know if you could say there's a demise of cinema, although, you know, there is a lot of talk about how the two biggest movies that came out this summer were Toy Story 3 and Iron Man 2, two franchise films, both of which I think were, you know, pretty great movies, but a lot of the other films that came out, smaller, lower budget independent films that came out, did not perform to the expectations of the studios. And the studios, a lot of people at the studios, I've, you know, been, you know, listening to Kim Masters on The Business from KCRW, and she talked about a lot of the buzz she hears of people at the studios and stuff, where that some people are saying, you know, it's over, you know, that it's done for. Like when a movie like The Kids Are All Right, which is, you know, got a really hot director, Lisa Cholodenko, and, you know, some big stars in it, comes out and, you know, is a pretty interesting dynamic family drama and cannot find or catch an audience at all over the course of the summer and does really disappointing money at the box office. I think, you know, the movie business in general is struggling to find ways to create and tell interesting stories that people want to go out and see. And I think something like Scott Pilgrim comes along, and while I think that, you know, visually there were some, and we can get into talking about the visual effects, I mean, I enjoyed some of the visuals. I mean, I thought they were, you know, pretty innovative. I liked the use of some of the heads-up display and the score stuff, and some of the little riffs and goofs, like a character turning into coins and stuff, were funny, you know, and they were cute. But when it's all said and done, the movie failed to me as a movie. An hour and 10 minutes in, I did not care one bit about a single character in the story. It just didn't matter. It was just like it was a bunch of running gags of, you know, fight sequences and weird audio cues and a kind of a, what I felt was sort of a schizophrenic editing style that it never let you stop and take a breath in the story and like identify with the character in any way. And maybe that's because I don't play enough video games. But if that's really the case, then, you know, I say, you know, God help us all. I think society is doomed. You know,
I mean, for me, it's a slacker kid who I don't care about, who acts badly, daydreaming a story in his own head that I don't care about, and is just both immature. And you try telling me that guy's 22. Like, I know lots of really intelligent, really great 22-year-olds I'd much prefer to have had a conversation with than sit through the film. But I'm going to shut up for a second. Tell us what you think.
I think it's really interesting to me that my experience of the film and my wife's experience, my wife, who, by the way, does not necessarily play video games or read comic books, we both loved it and we both really identified with the characters and actually cared about them at the end. And I think part of that is, for some reason, and I don't know why, but I thought the sort of dreamlike, non-linear way in which the story was told was refreshing, and I thought it was much, much more interesting than a lot of the crap that has just been churned out over the last couple of years called a film. I mean, I would much, much, much rather see Scott Pilgrim versus the World Part 2 than another Starsky and Hutch, or you know, another bad remake of the A-Team, or something that I thought was, you know, marginally palatable in the 70s or 80s and now is turned into a big budget Hollywood film. And so for me, it was just a matter of being refreshing, and I found it, I liked it. I thought the characters were extremely, you know, you say slacker and these kind of things, but I thought they were very authentic. I mean, I don't know how many 22-year-olds in the U.S. you actually know, but, you know, the Scott Pilgrim character is not very far.
I sit in a classroom twice a week with 60 of them, so.
So Jason, Jason, you said something that you said that it wasn't aimed at us. So could you guys both talk to that? Canon, both you and Jason, like who was this film aimed at?
Well, I was going to say two things. One, that I thought this film, as you were talking, Canon, I had a thought that this film actually felt very akin to Roger Avery's Rules of Attraction, the Bret Easton Ellis.
Oh, God, book, love that film. Love
which,
it.
Which
love
I
it.
Love, and I think stylistically was similar in the way that it used its storytelling. But also, Matt, what you were saying before about I think you had mentioned Iron Man and how you didn't care about the characters and the filmmaking was sort of subpar. That's actually exactly how I felt about Iron Man 2. The way you feel about this movie is sort of the way I felt about Iron Man 2. I won't get into that's a whole nother. We already had that conversation, but but it's, you know, I think one of the things that really appealed to me about the movie is that I grew up as an 18-year-old kid, 17, 18-year-old kid in New York City, playing in bands, trying to get girls, trying to get gigs. So that whole aspect of the film actually really appealed to me, and I'm a huge music nerd to the nth degree. So all the stuff of like Nigel Godrich, who worked with you know, Beck and Radiohead and all those people who were working on the film, I could identify their sort of influences. It was nice to sit in a movie theater with really loud music. But also, you know, the first Sex Bomb song was like a direct nod, as they did visually with other nods. The music was a direct nod to like Black Flag's Nervous Breakdown and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff Absolutely. Really spoke to me. Just to me, and all it made me do was say, and maybe this obscured the other things that maybe I wouldn't have liked about the film if it wasn't there, but to me it really made me sit there and daydream myself and be like, oh man, I wish I was 22 and trying to get a gig at CB's again. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You think there was something aspirational about this film? Did I just hear that correctly?
Well, for
yes,
me.
Yes, you did.
I'm saying for me.
Okay.
Because that was very similar to how my life was, except I didn't know any girl that had dated seven guys who wanted to beat my ass. Or women.
Seven. Yeah.
Well, seven exes.
You never had a sex. Never had a sexy face. Can I ask you? Well, see, for me, this was, you know, when you see a Quentin Tarantino and it's one of his bad films and it's incredibly self-indulgent and references really, really obscure grindhouse type films, and you go, really? I mean, you know, you do good films and then you just get so self-indulgent, there's no one real. And then I found out that Edgar Wright actually showed this to Tarantino and he liked it. And I'm like, yeah, that totally makes sense to me. Like, this is people making films at a really big budget for a really niche crowd. And it's so, you know, if it was anything else, I'd call it pretentious because it's so up its own ass in its own self-referential world of obscure references to video game monologues from like games from like years ago. And
wow,
I mean, it's really hard for me to respect that.
I really want to call you out on that because I have a very large and wonderful group of friends, and the references from Black Flag, which, you know, was mentioned all the way across, I would not call them obscure at all. I mean, when the door opens and it's the Legend of Zelda theme song, or, you know, there's Seinfeld music in it.
That wasn't obscure, I don't understand. I'll give you that.
Right, but see, that's what I'm saying. To you, the Seinfeld wasn't obscure, and to me, the Black Flag reference wasn't obscure, or the fact that the guy is wearing a Plumtree t-shirt. I was like, hell yes. Do you know who Plumtree is? That's right. It's an all-girl indie band that released a song called Scott Pilgrim, which is what the comic book was named after. You know, and so to me, it was like, this is fantastic. I mean, it was all of the references that I think my generation really gets. And okay. So when you talk about the age of the audience, I think my generation, the really kind of somewhat nerdy kids who grew up on comic books and video games who are, you know, now making movies, which is why Comic-Con rocks, I think we're the ones that really get it. And that's not a small group of people.
Well, it's not a very good group in terms of going to a box office, though, is it?
No, and that's an unfortunate mistake, and it's the same mistake Fight Club made. They targeted the wrong audience, which is why I believe, and I will stand by this, and we will see if it plays out. I think this movie is going to just smoke on rentals and you know, DVD-like sales. I think it is really going to take off in the same way that Fight Club did. Okay. And find
before we discuss
audience.
The VFX, can I just get from you and Jason the age or the demographic that this is aimed at? Like, who did they make this for? Just really simply.
I think the general basic story was like the 18 to 25, and the overall film with all the references together would be like 18 to 35.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say the movie going 16 to 25 crowd was the surface, and then, you know, like, it's the same thing the Matrix had, right? The Matrix was this fun.
How many minutes in before we got to the Matrix?
I mean, it's an obvious thing, right? But yeah. it appeals on two levels. It appeals on the let's go kick some ass level, which is the movie going crowd who spend their parents' dollars, and then it appeals on the other crowd, which is the guys that buy it on DVD or whatever. And I think that this film is squarely bullseye targeting Generation X, which is my generation.
Okay. Can I just say one last thing before we start discussing the visual effects? Did anyone really buy that she would be into him?
Well, she did say you're the nicest guy I ever dated, so that sort of goes to the George Costanza, you know, be the anti-George.
Okay. I just have to weigh in really quickly. Like, you talk about the, you know, I'm still Generation X, even in the, you know, being 40 years old now. But like, you know, growing up in the 80s and going to, you know, punk shows at Fender's in Long Beach and stuff. Like, you know, you talk about the references to Black Flag and stuff like that. I do think a lot of the kids, you know, that I have in my classroom, a lot of them, they might know Black Flag. They might know, you know, who Black Flag is, but I don't think they've spent a lot of time listening to Black Flag. And I guess, you know, those kind of references I think are fun, and they're kind of cool that they're inserted into the overall narrative, and that kind of help embellish that world somewhat. But I look at something like that and I just think, well, you know, there's so many other movies that have been made that kind of tap into that. I don't know if did you guys ever see that Shane Meadows movie, that This Is England?
Oh, yeah, magnificent.
Which is a fantastic film, and, you know, it's kind of dealing with sort of the UK side of some of that sort of Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan era, you know, sort of post-70s punk rock movement, where it was a little bit more
fight oriented, I guess, in the UK. But you know, and that, but that's, of course, it's not a comedy, right? Either. So you know, but it's delving into some of those things in a really nostalgic kind of way for people, I think, of our generation. But I guess I just feel like even those references in Scott Pilgrim, for me, you know, you talk about what the demographic is, and you know, I just feel like, oh, okay, well, there you have it. Like, I'm outside of that.
Yeah, I mean, I reckon there was a lot of references in there that you had to be 40 to get, because I mean, I grew up with, you know, Pong, and went to, you know, Pac-Man and to Galaxica, and then went to, you know, Super Mario, and the Super Mario references were pretty heavy and thick on this, and my kids wouldn't have got any of that, and nor would anyone, I reckon, under the age. But hey, let's move to VFX. There's a lot of visual effects in this film, a heck of a lot. There's 1,200, mainly done by Double Negative and Mr. X. Both companies I personally really, really like. Double Negative, as most people know, I have an enormous amount of respect for in their seamless visual effects work. This is a very stylized set of visual effects. Can I just get you to go around and sort of name anything that you thought worked really, really effectively? Because there were some big on-screen obvious visual effects in this, and I mean obvious in the sense that the audience was meant to notice them. A dragon coming out from a speaker stack is not an invisible effect, though there were those as well in terms of stylizing some of Toronto. So starting maybe with you, Jason, what did you really like visual effects wise just visual effects?
Yeah, I liked the really subtle stuff they did, where it was like it would be split screens, like at the party, but the people walking by that would wipe the cuts were outside of the split screen, like real subtle stuff like that. And then all the way up to, I did really like the big Yeti that came out from the Sexpa bombs fighting the Japanese guys' dragons. The sort of really mega scale effects. I think my favorite effect from a comedy standpoint was the Brandon Routh vegan, yeah. both the storyline and the effects accompanying it were pretty classic.
Kanan?
Well, there wasn't anything in it that I didn't like. I mean, I liked everything that Jason mentioned. I very, very much liked the walking around and comic pain movement. I thought the little touches, like the 8-bit graphics around all of the really nice special effects, like, there's this really... Mm-hmm. Fantastic scene with Ramona where she has this like Thor's hammer type thing, and it's got these nice glowing 8-bit graphics around it. I thought all of it worked. I mean, it worked perfectly in the context of the world that they had created.
And in the limited time you were in the cinema, Matt, was there anything that you...
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. Looking back at some of the materials, I saw that image of the Ramona character with the hammer, and I actually really did like that image. I thought that was really striking. But the stuff that, you know, I saw a good 70 minutes of the movie, and the things that I think I really did like, the visuals. I mean, I thought visually it was really fun to look at, and I liked in that the first fight scene with, I guess it was, what's his name? Was it Jason Schwartzman or whatever, where they're fighting in
Gideon, yeah.
Oh, right. Evil boyfriend number one?
Yeah, I think so. But mm-hmm. I can't remember which number it was, but but there were some great shots of that were, you know, lifted right out of the comic book. But I like what they did visually with the effects in terms of the style of having like a close up of, you know, the evil boyfriend or of the Michael Cera character, and the way in which their hair was blowing and there was like streaks, you know, going across, and they had a fist out and they were kind of arcing across the screen coming towards each other, and they were going to collide. And then the other stuff that I thought was great were really simple things, kind of like what you were saying, Jason. I think I liked the stuff with the, I don't even know if it was a visual effect, it was more of an audio gag or an editorial gag, but you know, the girl who every time she talked to him, she called him some bad name, and they sort of bleeped out what she was saying with this weird inaudible kind of like kind of sound. And and then one of the, I think the Knives character at one point, right around the time we were about to leave, they did something with her face where they put this like weird mask over her face, like in post, and it gave her these kind of like X's for eyes or something like that, and just a big line for a mouth. That and then all the editorial stuff that they did, I think, like you were saying, Kanan, where they did these really interesting transitions. I mean, I love that stuff. It reminded me of the kinds of things that Francis Ford Coppola experimented around with on, but he replicated some of that in Tucker as well, where they did all those kind of interesting sort of in-camera transitions. I think these were mostly done in post, if I'm not mistaken, but I thought that stuff was really great. And the only thing that I wound up really having a problem with you know, well, in conjunction with that, was just the pacing of it. I think was just, it was relentless. It was like a nonstop onslaught.
Yeah, I found it to be mind-numbingly repetitive in its pacing, and they were trying to know to make it relentless, but I didn't get that. And in hearing about the books, which I absolutely have not read, it felt like the books spanned 2 years. They moved in together, they did all this kind of stuff, and the film was like a condensed version of a more of a fling. So it was one to the next to the next. I will say there's one sequence that was exceptionally well cut, though I do criticize the overall editing, which was him leaving his apartment, jumping through the window, the way they pulled focus on that, and then his hand comes back to get the jacket. I mean, that was just exquisitely executed and played incredibly well in a trailer. And, you know, that alone, if I did that one shot, I'd feel really, really good about it because it just was so well timed, so well done. And it was funny.
Were most of those transitions, were they all done in post, or were any of those done like as in camera things? Do you guys know in anything that you read about it or heard about it?
Yeah, my understanding is that a lot of those transitions were done in post. And if you take a look, and this is a slight aside, but if you take a look at a lot of the visual effects in this film, and this is totally worth mentioning, the many of those, including some a lot of the transitions and a lot of the comic book borders and all that, were done in Photoshop. There was a shocking amount of Photoshop used to create a lot of the, you know, the effects in this film, including the scene where they're walking around and it's this kind of snowy scene. There's a lot of 2.5D Photoshop work there. And that when they punch and you hear, you know, you see the words, the sort of Batman style words pop out, a lot of that was even in Photoshop.
Well, that stuff was lifted actually right. I think they scanned it right out of the book and put it in so that it would match, you know.
I will say one other sequence I want to...
Awesome.
Just, yeah, as if. One of the other things I thought was really well done is Dean Egg's sequence on the Battle of the Bands. You know, they actually, and I think I'm right in saying Andrew Whitehurst did this, but they actually floated balloons to get eye lines for the band on either side of that room. I think that scene was very well done, that sense of playing against a bigger rival, the Marshall Stack. And then the actual animated creatures that came out were both appropriate. If you were in this world that you bought into, then they were terrific in this world. And it gave the band that underdog status, but by the same token, you kind of could get behind them beating these two twins on the other side and stuff. And I think that sequence, and even the sequence just preceding it where he's identifying what's going on in the audience and how that was lit and stuff, I don't think that I would really say that scene was in any way poorly executed. I think that was a well-handled scene. I thought, by comparison, I felt like I was in a relatively low-budget environment when we had Boyfriend Number Vegan, which was He 3. Is He 3 or 2?
I think he's 3.
Yeah, and that whole going through the wall stuff, for me, really felt stagey and felt lacking in kind of finesse. I just couldn't get that. It just felt like we were on a small soundstage and we were doing...
That to me, because when Thomas Jane and Clifton Collins come in as like the vegan police, that to me felt like a nod to like the Naked Gun or something like that, like a little over the top kind, like... All right.
No, I'm with you, but I'm not talking about the plot now. I mean, I'm just talking about the visual effects of going through the walls and stuff.
No, I'm aware of that, but I'm just saying that refers to the visual effects, that they played the visual effects sort of like, you know, the big, you know, bricky cutout, kind of like a wobbly wall, you know, a little bit of through the wall effect. I think the effects informed the campiness a little bit. I could be wrong, but that's how it felt. Like, they're like, okay, this fight, we have to make all the fights different because it's going to get really boring, which it actually did. And I agree with you that by the time I was at number 4, I was like, all right, I really have to see 7 of these.
The one that killed me was when they did the end fight, and I thought I was finished, and they said, no, we're going to go back for another one. And I was like, oh, no. And then they went, oh, now I've got evil me. And I was like, I was at that point, I was like, I can't walk out now, but Trust me, if I'd had a remote control in my hand, I'd have been, you know, you can make me watch
this
once.
But that was
once.
A pretty good joke,
Make me watch
no?
it twice, but three times with Evil Me? Oh, my God.
It was
I thought it was a pretty great joke when you think they're going to have to fight Evil Me, and then they just walk out, and he's like, all right, see you later. We'll get some breakfast or something. I thought that was – he's a really nice guy, you know. I thought that was
a really great joke.
Go
for waffles.
Yeah.
Whatever yeah. it was.
What did you think about the skateboarding sequence? Sorry.
Where he goes down the railing?
Well, that whole sequence. It's the fight sequence that has, you know, obviously a bunch of body double slash stuntmen. You know, they do a fight sequence and then it ends up with the skateboard going down, yeah.
I actually liked it. I was reading in the materials that they actually, on all the hits, they would use flash bulbs on set to get some onset, you know, practical lighting, and they went through something like 7,000 bulbs or something. Through the film, not necessarily that scene, but I thought was it Chris Evans from Fantastic Four, right? Played the character. I thought he did a great job. It was really like almost like a takeoff on himself to a certain extent.
The guy who played Lucas Lee, right?
Yeah, the guy who played Lucas Lee. I thought it was a nice turn for him, and I like that. I mean, it's obvious that you knew he was going to goad him into doing the skateboard trick because how else would he beat him? And it was sort of a nod to like Tony Hawk or one of those video games. I don't know. I enjoyed it. It was fairly simple.
Sorry,
it
I just didn't
like
get that. I didn't get the Hawk reference until you said it. Okay.
It didn't seem. I mean, obviously, it was insanely complex, but it was one of the more simple, just sort of fighting, more choreographed scenes than maybe over the top visual effects per se.
Okay, Kanan?
Yeah. Did you catch that that Lucas Lee is the middle name of the two people that created the Scott Pilgrim comic book? I thought that was funny.
Don't know. Don't care.
I liked...
Talk about pretentious. No, we're not going back there. Let's keep going. What did you think about the visual effects of the skateboarding?
I thought it worked. I was going to...
Work with me here, man. I'm trying to stay on track.
No. I was gonna pull the Pushing Daisies card. The Pushing Daisies card is, I think you don't like Scott Pilgrim for the same reason that you didn't like Pushing Daisies, which is
that it's bad.
which is that the world is a very hyper realized, very odd world that you have to buy into from the beginning. And I remember that you were not a big fan of the stylized effects in Pushing Daisies. And I felt like this film had a kind of Pushing Daisies-like feel to it. And I remember actually when we left it, my wife and I actually had that conversation over dinner afterwards as we said, that's the most surreal thing we've seen since Pushing Daisies. So I loved it all.
I swear
can't
to
say
God,
one bad thing about it.
I swear to God, it's really not about the stylized thing. I can actually work with a universe. I'm a father. I have children. I see lots of very stylized things. I don't have a problem with that. I actually just didn't care about the characters. I didn't care about the story. But let's stay back with the visual effects because and also I'm mortified at how much work went into this film, how much they thought about it, how much they weren't rushing it, how much money they spent, how much they intellectualized it, how much they referenced, and how the end product looked. But anyway, that's me. Let's get back to the visual effects. Okay, so we had a big sequence with the skateboard. We kind of touched on that. I certainly liked the band sequence. I thought that was good. Let's talk about the end sequence in the nightclub, the sequence that runs through twice with Gideon and the staging of that. There's obviously a requirement to have a big ending, though we saw this sequence twice with kind of, you know, the Scooby-Doo ending. Matt, I can't ask you about this because you weren't there, but but I will ask Jason, what did you think of the Gideon fight sequences?
It was my least favorite. It was a little long, although I did like the lead up to it. The when Michael Cera was walking up to the thing and they were like, what's the password? He's like, whatever. And they were like, okay, go ahead in. I kind of liked all that sort of off the cuff stuff. But the fight did seem, I know it was just a little sort of blah. Although that was the scene that took the longest for them to shoot. So maybe that is part of it. Edgar Wright said he does like to work really fast, and they were on that set for the longest, and he was like, I'm really nervous that this isn't going to work because we're really, like, agonizing over this. I liked the sword coming out of the chest. You know, he gained self-respect, and then he gets the sword, and I did like that they used plexiglass swords with LEDs in them for, you know, that they really took the time to capture as much on-set practical, referential and usable lighting, motion blur, things like that to inform the visual effects later when they had to replace and construct the visual effects.
So just technically, this was the sequence that ended up being shot with the Phantom, right? They were doing like 250 frames per second kind of stuff on this, where the rest of the film was pretty much shot on film, if I think I'm right in saying that.
I can't agree or disagree on that. I thought they just sprinkled the Phantom around a little bit. I didn't realize the whole scene was Phantom.
Oh, I don't know if the whole scene was Phantom. I'm just saying that was like... Because this was I mean, this was a very... Because the fights were meant to mirror his self-confidence and his attitude towards the relationship, obviously at the end he's come around to "I really care about her," so he cares about the fight, where obviously some of the earlier ones it was more like, apart from the first one, like I couldn't care less.
Yes, yes.
Nor could I, by the way. do you feel like that we got kind of, I guess, a weight of visuals that represented that finale? I mean, did it feel like the visuals? Because it was, you know, it's a bit of a challenge in a sense, because you've already got this incredible over-the-top visual style. It didn't leave them a lot of places to go for the sort of big finale. Now, I mean, you can put a staircase in and somebody sitting on top of a ridiculous nightclub. But I'm talking about now the visuals that they were doing in terms of the fighting, the action sequences, the flaming swords. Cannon, did you feel like that stylistically they'd left themselves room to move?
No, I think that I actually agree with you a little bit, and that and some of the things that have been said. This was the least visually interesting and the least, and the part of the film that I had the least interest in actually watching or caring about. Now, that, you know, that means a 7 instead of a 10.
I understand.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I did, though, look at it, and there's a couple of things, if you're not a total dork like me about these things, you wouldn't have noticed it. I mean, it's kind of sad that actually, you know, David isn't on the show, because I think he would have caught a lot of this too. For example, I believe one of the swords is the sword from the Soul Calibur video game series. And so I had trouble. I was so excited about that I actually had trouble. I almost wanted to see the movie again, because I spent a full 2 minutes going, "Holy shit, it's Soul Calibur," which was, you know, again, that's just my own. That's the color of my crystal, so, you know. But I liked it, just not as much.
It was the visual effects, or even just the filmmaking and storytelling in general in the last fight, did go from, they were on 10 and they could go to like 11, a little Spinal Tappy 11. You know, like there wasn't a huge range to go in terms of what haven't we seen, what could we do, you know.
See, like, I must admit that I actually found the very amusing, the sequence when on the date they were doing the coordinated dance move kung fu thing. Can somebody tell me what the game was? He and his girlfriend are, what's that, you know, they, I mean, I've seen it as a dancing thing, but it was supposed to
be Dance Dance Revolution, but I've never seen the fighting one.
And
no, it doesn't exist. They created it specifically for the film.
Great. So thank you for that, because I had no idea what it was. But I assumed that they were going to just play that sequence in the end, and I thought that was going to be nice. When I got to the end, when they were very close to doing that, I thought that they was literally going to do the move that we'd seen earlier in the film, and that would, like, you know, shut him down, and it would be shut down because he'd be so amazed at the coordinated move that they did. It kind of almost went there but didn't. But I don't know that... I had a lot of I just didn't feel like that. Like, they had some really nice work with the coins appearing and stuff like that, but I just didn't feel like visually they'd left themselves a lot of room. And I think it was a fairly lit set as well, which didn't help matters a lot, because it was kind of hard at that point to be that dramatic when you could see that. Well, if that had been a much more smoke-filled laser kind of environment that was darker, harder, and edgier. But it was still very... I mean, this is a film that really loved its saturated colors, and it loved its primaries in particular. It just didn't feel that it carried a lot of weight that end. Now, I know people don't smoke in clubs anymore, but nevertheless, there are smoke machines. I just said, you know, if I was doing that over, how could I have improved that is a question I always ask myself. Not that I am presumptuous enough to assume that I could, but I think it's a good question. Like, if it doesn't work, why? Can we articulate the way that is? And I just didn't feel like there was much room left for them to go to. Maybe could have held a few things back for that.
Yeah, I probably would have gone more referential to Tron in that ending scene myself.
Yeah, I think if there was a lot of really good game references in the end, that would have pleased someone like you, Cannon. That was great. I didn't get those, so I guess it just left me a bit flat. But I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Me too.
Do you want to discuss anything about the grading and the actual final mastering? I mean, it's a very saturated palette. There's lots of light effects and stuff that are going on in this. But obviously they try to make each fight distinctive. Do you think they succeeded?
I think they did. I did want to say that as far as the color was concerned, that was my least favorite aspect of this surreal world that they've created. I thought that the color was somewhat inconsistent with itself. And so, they tried way, way too hard. I mean, when you go from one fight to the next, the color changes completely. I mean, the whole Superman vegan color palette, I honestly had no idea what was going on with that color palette. It seemed a little...
From an effects point of view, confused. Did you think the white eyes thing worked?
Well, it worked in the context of the world they created, sure.
Yeah, it didn't bother me. I thought a lot of the night times, like when they were walking around town at night in the snow, actually felt a little like Let the Right One In a little bit. They had those sort of wide tracking shots.
What a great film, too. Yeah, what a great comparison. I would not have caught that. That's fantastic.
I thought the lighting of the, when they walked up early on to the snow swing, I thought that was gorgeously lit and beautifully done and was well executed. I felt that the vegan fight night stuff felt like there was lots of unmotivated lighting. But then again, you may tell me that it's completely reasonable to have lots of unmotivated lighting because it's a world where anything is reasonable, which is kind of half my problem.
Well, did anyone catch when he first, when Ramona comes to his house to deliver the package, which as an aside, Michael Cera actually did throw that package into the garbage can after a couple tries, went right in. It's not a visual effect. But when she skated away in the snow, that the snow was like melting in front of her. Did you see that? And she left sort of a melted swath. I like that was a nice subtle touch as well.
You're laughing?
Yeah, no, I. It's funny that I wouldn't have called that subtle. I thought that was. I mean, I guess.
Well,
it's
I mean,
subtle
it's stylized, but it's not
film.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that was, I mean, it was fantastic. And, you know, it's funny, though, that you do say subtle because there were a couple people that saw the film and they were in their early 20s. And I mentioned two things. I mentioned first that the package she delivers is Hot Fuzz. So you want to talk about self-referential. He orders Hot Fuzz on Blu-ray and that's what she delivers. But anyway, I mentioned that.
Of course he does.
And then I mentioned the snow melting. And they were like, what? The snow melted? So maybe it was subtle within the context of the film. Because several people did not see it.
Yeah, I think Mr. X may have done the snow stuff. Is that right? Does anyone know? I feel that they were... I'm pretty sure they did a bunch of snow stuff because this was obviously shot in Toronto, as I said, 5.5 months. I don't know they necessarily had perfect snow for each of the scenes that required it.
Yeah,
yeah. I think they handled a lot of the snow and plate, a lot of the plate and matte painting work.
Yeah, I think Mr. X, from the work that Ian Fales did on FX Guide, I'm pretty sure they did about 212 of those 1,200 shots. Again, as I said earlier, this wasn't a rush film. I think they had, in Ian's story, I think they talk about having about 6 months before pre-production started and the production designer came down and they were like well-versed in being able to do this stuff. I mean, there is a crafting to this film and... The criticism isn't in execution for me, and it isn't in that they were rushed, and it isn't that the studio forced them to do anything that I thought was crap. Nor do I think the director actually was forced to do anything that was crap. So I don't like the film. I did leave only briefly to get an ice cream because I was bored, and came back in. So I don't think I missed much. But I do again almost lament the fact that there was that much attention to detail and that much serious thought that went into it, and yet I just felt that the film kind of didn't work. And there you go. Obviously, you guys did. And you know what? I mean, I am sure a lot of people that are listening to this are yelling at their iPods or their car stereos, telling me that I don't know shit and that it was one of the greatest films ever. But I will say this, I don't like this trend, and this is not just this film. This film's getting the brunt of my... I didn't want to do a Kick-Ass VFX show. I didn't want to do a Watchmen VFX show. Mm-hmm. I don't embrace these trends for... And Matt, help me out here, but, you know, original scripts are a marvelous thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just comes down to, you know, when it's all said and done, you know, it's fun that there's, you know, opportunities for different kinds of movies to be made. I mean, film is a subjective medium, and not everybody is going to like every movie that comes out. And, you know, I think not every movie is intended to reach the broadest audience either. And I think that's okay, and I don't think that that's really something that you know, we have to sort of denigrate. But I do think, you know, there is an expectation for me as a film goer. You know, I mean, I'm contradicting myself a little bit here, but you know, that when I go to a film, that I'm going to see someone tell me a story. I think with Scott Pilgrim and with maybe some of the other films you mentioned there, Mike, I mean, I think, you know, I do get some great visuals, and in the case of this film, as well as some of those other films, you know, maybe we do get some really great visual effects, but I often walk out of those films feeling really like, you know, I saw some really cool things that looked really pretty neat, but I don't walk away with, you know, sort of a cathartic emotional experience where I feel as if I've been either taken to some place really fun and joyous, or, you know, had some sort of, you know, dark, moody tale told to me where I walk out feeling, you know, affected that way either. And I just think it's one of those things where, you know, when it's all said and done, like, the story is king. And I love it when I see things like, you know, we talked about Inception a couple shows back, and when an original film comes out that's, you know, created by an auteur-type filmmaker who is a writer, director, and who is executing totally unique and original material. And I think it's unfortunate. In Hollywood right now, there is a dearth of originality. I mean, they're making a movie about the game Battleship, right? I mean, who cares? I don't know if I want to see that movie. Like,
hey, they made a fucking Facebook movie, and Fincher did it. I have zero desire to see it. I don't care. It's David Fincher.
No, I'm calling on that. I actually think Fincher's film will be really interesting to watch.
Sure it will, but like,
but it's not a movie about the Facebook page. It's about how it came to be. There's an arc and a story. It's not. If you tell me they were making a film out of David Fincher's Facebook page, I'd agree with you.
I appreciate that, but the end result is that they created Facebook.
Okay. I think there are lots of interesting stories to be told, and I don't have a problem with any of them. But look, you know, hey, we're here to disagree, and that's not a problem. I totally respect you guys. I appreciate that.
Respect.
But yeah, but you don't know dick on
with
this
a little
one.
R.
Hey, look, there's no accounting for taste. That's all I can say.
But look, you know, if I'm right and no one's seen this film, which is pretty much what the box office is saying, then a lot of people will see this on DVD, and no doubt there'll be lots of extras, and maybe you can delve into some of these things. I think there is a bigger question to be asked, which is how much a film needs to be valid based on how much it can assume the audience has a literary or zeitgeist or cultural thesaurus going in. In other words, is this film only valid if I'm immersed in the culture enough to get every one of their clever in jokes? And I know that there were a lot of them that I didn't get. But, you know, that'd be true of anything, right? Like, you could make a Shakespeare film and it's all got cute little Shakespeare whips, and if you hate Shakespeare, you'd find it boring, and if you loved it, you'd find it amazing how they managed to weave that into the dialogue. Only it would go on to win an Oscar, and this doesn't. But thank you so much for being with us, guys. Where can people find you? I'll start with you, Jason.
On the Twitters, Jason Diamond, one word, or my website, mbsproductions.com.
Kenan?
You can find me if you Google Life Zero on the top 40,000 hits or whatever.
Matt?
At mattwallen.com or in Richmond, Virginia, at Virginia Commonwealth University at the School of the Arts.
And You'll find me over at FX Guide, and of course I'm on the Twitters at Mike Seymour. I'm heading off to IBC in Europe. We're going to be doing some interesting shows coming up on the VFX show. We've got a good one coming up on Salt. Also, somebody actually sent us an email, guys, saying we'd never done Terminator 2. Is that true? I hope that is not true.
No way.
But if it is true that we've not done Terminator 2 and we are going to go through the archives, then we will definitely be doing a Terminator 2 VFX show, retro show coming up. I just want to appreciate that it does take all types to make this good world that we live in. And if you're one of the ones that sternly disagrees, feel free to email us. All comments are considered. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks so much for being with us. Bye.